KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Shay Stevens. President Trump has signed an executive order that he says will begin the shutdown of the Department of Education. As NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports, that may not be so easy.
Trump's order vastly scales down the education department, but it can't be entirely eliminated because that would require an act of Congress. The president cited reading and math test scores that declined during the pandemic as one of the reasons to close down the department, which has already laid off hundreds of staff.
We're not doing well with the world of education in this country, and we haven't for a long time.
Trump said things like Pell Grants, Title I resources, and funding for students with disabilities and special needs will remain intact, but will be managed by other departments and agencies. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
A federal judge in Maryland has blocked Elon Musk's Doge team from accessing personal data at the Social Security Administration. The court also ruled that Doge must delete any personally identifiable information it's gathered so far. More from NPR's Ashley Lopez.
In her ruling, Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote that Musk's team has essentially been engaged in what she called a fishing expedition at the Social Security Administration. And this expedition, she wrote, has been based on little more than suspicion of fraud. The judge also noted that the agency gave members of Musk's team, quote, unbridled access to the personal and private data of millions of Americans. That includes Social Security numbers, medical records, and bank and credit card information. And while the court has now limited Doge's access to much of that information, it does say that the agency is still allowed to hand over data that adheres to federal privacy laws. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
California and three other states are suing the Environmental Protection Agency for freezing $20 billion in clean energy grants. The plaintiffs say the EPA is breaking the law by ending funding that was already approved by Congress. New data from the National Association of Realtors shows an uptick in U.S. home sales last month. But as NPR's Laura Walmsley reports, there is a lot of uncertainty heading into the spring home buying season.
Analysts had expected home sales to drop in February, as they had the month before. But instead, sales of existing homes rose more than 4% over January, at a seasonally adjusted rate. And prices kept climbing. The median home price reached $398,000, the highest ever for the month of February. As the spring buying season warms up, more homes are coming on the market. Inventory is up 17% from a year ago. But affordability remains a big challenge, as mortgage rates stay well above 6%. The housing market has been strongest at the top recently, but with the stock market taking a hit in recent weeks, the demand for luxury homes could soften. Laurel Walmsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading. This is NPR. A federal judge says the government may not deport a detained Georgetown University graduate fellow who's from India. Badr Khan Suri was arrested Monday night at his home in Arlington, Virginia. He's accused of spreading Hamas propaganda and promoting anti-Semitism on social media. Attorney Hassan Ahmad says his client has not engaged in political activism and believes DHS's allegations stem from the actions of Suri's father-in-law. Music legend Sir Elton John is well known for his philanthropic efforts and is among a small group of people who've won Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Awards. As Jeff London reports, the songwriter has now been awarded the 15th Glenn Gould Prize for Impact on the Arts and Humanity.
Glenn Gould was a brilliant, eccentric pianist whose performances and recordings were prized. After Gould passed away in 1982, a foundation was established in his memory. And this year, Elton John was named laureate of the Glenn Gould Prize. The pop legend is active in the fight against HIV/AIDS and advocates for a variety of LGBTQ plus causes. In winning what has been dubbed the Nobel Prize of the Arts, Elton John joins a prestigious company of previous winners, among them Yo-Yo Ma, Leonard Cohen, and Philip Glass. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Again, U.S. futures are flat and after-hours trading. On Asia-Pacific market, shares are lower. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
The Arctic Circle is an imaginary place. It includes a very real ocean with floating sea ice and caribou who move across the permafrost. The 4 million people who live within the circle also exist. The chilly winter wind is also real. But unlike a landmass you can point to, the Arctic Circle is not defined by physical borders. It's an imaginary circle of latitude around 66 degrees north. It's a circle that slices the top of the world and runs through 8 countries, including the U.S., and it is undergoing real and profound change. But before we talk about how climate change is affecting the circle north of 66 degrees and the greater polar region we call the Arctic, how it's warming 4 times faster than the rest of the planet, and what it's like to witness changes to one of the last wild places, we'll share what it was like to be there when its cold climate was stable. A naturalist describes his youthful experience in the Arctic and what he saw when he returned 30 years later. Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley, and this episode is The Amazing Arctic. The Arctic is a place of immense landscape and sky, is how John Waterman described the area that he first journeyed to in 1983. He has worn a lot of fleece hats during his years working and traveling through the Arctic. He was a park ranger at Denali National Park, part of the Alaska Range, south of the Arctic Circle. He is a photographer and author who has traveled extensively through our frozen north solo on foot and by kayak on the Noatak River in the gates of the Arctic National Park. So to help us appreciate the wildlife and conditions that may be slipping away, which he documents in the book Into the Thaw, we asked John first to take us there. So imagine you stepped out of your tent and you're standing on tundra at the top of the world. What do you see when you look around you?
Well, it's very hallucinogenic because there aren't the normal visual cues that you would expect to find elsewhere in our natural world. Because much of the Arctic is treeless and you're on tundra. That lack of orientation is also about the scale of things. The valleys are much wider. So looking across a valley, normally we're accustomed to valleys that are in much of the lower 48 that are a couple of miles across. And the valleys of the Arctic, if you're in a mountainous region, can be many miles across. And then there's the Arctic coastal plain, where it's utterly flat. And what you see when you look around you typically can be a vast expanse of tundra with nothing to differentiate it, unless you happen to be near a river or on the coast. And then you can look and see an endless plain of ocean with sea ice looming the far horizon. And often there are mirages that cause the sea ice to rise up in front of your eyes. And so when I encounter that kind of thing, I find myself turning around and looking back behind me at the tundra to just keep perspective and look away from the mirages. So just imagine being in your own favorite landscape, but take away the trees, take away all signs of people, and everything is much further apart.
Now, this next question now feels redundant because I think you've already described it inadvertently, but when you first went to the Arctic in 1983, you said it captured your soul. I think we have an idea that that is true, but what did you mean by that?
Well, I've always felt a certain freedom in the outdoors. It presented an opportunity to me that I hadn't found anywhere else in life. And there's a sense of the unlimited in the Arctic, because you can see so far without any development or people. So it's very freeing. And I just, the way that I happen to be constructed, I tend to get claustrophobic if I'm around a lot of people or if I'm in a city. So it captured my soul because of those unlimited horizons and because I didn't feel any of that claustrophobia that I felt in many other places. It was the outdoors and then some. It was nature on speed for me because the possibilities seemed endless. And it was also otherworldly at the same time, unlike any of my other experiences in the southern biosphere.
Now, you said that you didn't mind getting away from people. Maybe you did need to get away from people. But you weren't totally alone, and you haven't been totally alone in the Arctic. There are animals around. And we may be surprised to learn how much wildlife is above the Arctic Circle. Now, some of these species introduce themselves to you in a dramatic fashion. Can you describe one of your first memorable encounters with caribou?
Well, I hasten to add that much of the Arctic is technically a desert. And so there are times, days, or you can go weeks without actually seeing more than a lemming or birds. It's rare not to see a lot of birds. But then everything would change dramatically when you're near the caribou. Because when the caribou migrate through, they migrate through by the thousands or at least the hundreds. And they tend to be trailed by foxes and wolves and bears and even birds that are looking for opportunities, young calves or injured animals that they can prey upon. So everything changes. And it happened that my first experience in the Arctic, we were constantly surrounded by caribou. And my memory and experience is a very sensory experience, because when you're close to caribou, their heels click like castanets. It's not because of the striking stones, it's just because there's ligaments in their legs that click. And they grunt, and if they are running through the river, which they often do, there's that noise of them coming through the river. So it's a very sensory experience, and when they rush by your tent, as it happened to me on my first visit, you can even smell them. And I witnessed on that first trip a wolf chasing a caribou right by our tent. So it's an extraordinary experience when you're amid the migration. And then again, you can go days without seeing any animals because it is a desert environment and it's hard for these animals to survive. They have to move great distances to find food.
When you witnessed the wolf chasing the caribou near your tent, were you in your tent and you heard the sound and you came out, or were you sitting near it and you heard it and you looked up and there they went right by your tent?
We were inside the tent and we were just slowly awakening, and we heard an animal plunge into the river, the Noatak River, across from us. And our immediate thought was that it was a bear. And my ranger companion grabbed the shotgun and chambered around in case it was a bear. Well, I was zipping open the tent and sticking my head out, and that's when the caribou ran by. And of course, I was astonished by that, but then immediately behind this caribou this fleeing caribou is a wolf that had silently jumped into the river. It was a great blonde wolf.
Oh my goodness. John, what do caribou smell like?
Oh, I think it's a, I live in a very rural part of Colorado, and I'm always reminded of them when I walk by the horse pastures. It's a different smell, but the smell that I remember from that particular experience, you know, how smells stay with us for, can stay with us for decades. The smell that I remember was the smell of wet wool sweaters.
Can we talk bear?
I love to talk bears.
First, let's just identify which bear are in the Arctic Circle in Alaska, and I believe it's brown bear, not black bear, right? And what are you keeping your eye out for? What kind of bear?
Well, you know, classically, we refer, the brown bear refers to this very well-fed bear in southern Alaska that's eating a lot of salmon, and they can be over 1,000 pounds.
Now, is that grizzly?
Well, depending on where you are, you know, in Canada, they call the bears up in the Arctic the barren ground grizzly because they roam over these barren ground areas where there aren't any trees and it's all tundra. And some people in Alaska, in northern Alaska, refer them to them as grizzlies, which is what I call them. But they're really, they're exactly the same species as the brown bears. They just have a lot less food. And so they tend to be more aggressive, more omnivorous, and they tend to have much greater ranges. They can have ranges of hundreds of square miles versus the bears on the coast of Alaska where they're eating salmon, where they might only have a total range of 10 square miles because they don't need to go far to find food. So these bears in the north, the grizzlies I call them, they're very hungry all the time and they will seek out any opportunity for food.
Do they see you as prey?
Well, they will investigate you as prey. And if you give them the excuse, if you run away from them, for instance, then you are signaling to them that you are a potential prey and they will chase you. So you have to play this charade when you run into a grizzly. You have to pretend that you are not prey, even though you could easily become prey. But you can take it too far. And if you act aggressively with a male bear, for instance, that's very hungry, you could send the wrong signals. Now, there's another part of all this that I think that many people might not be aware of that I am always on the alert for, and that is that bears have an incredible sense of smell. The epithelium layers in their nose is so much more complex than that of human beings. And so they can smell what you've had for dinner the night before just by your through your breath. And so you have to not only carry on this charade of not being prey, you have to think about how you're going to block all the smells that the bear will be interested in. And that means not carrying toothpaste, certainly not any deodorant, and figuring out a way to contain your food. Ideally, if you fish, you have to eat the fish very quickly and throw all the guts into the stream or the river, because the bears will smell the fish and can smell them from miles away if the wind is blowing in the right direction.
And I understand that one of your techniques, you talk to the bear, like, "Hey, Mr. Bear," and that seems like a very polite way of interacting, but I'm guessing what you're doing is you're using your voice to let him or her know that you are, like, formidable but not threatening.
Exactly, yeah, to not be aggressive.
So how would you say it? How would you say it?
"Hello, Mr. Bear," and without raising my voice, but your movements are also really important too. Slow movements rather than jerky movements like a prey species might make.
One interesting thing about polar bears is I believe that polar bears are grizzlies, and they're white grizzly. Is that right?
Yeah, this is correct. 250,000 years ago or more, the brown bears, grizzly bears, whatever you'd like to call them, were cut off by the glaciers during the Great Ice Age. And these brown bears had to readapt to a new environment. They became marine mammals. They stayed out in the ocean and they hunted on the sea ice. They learned to hunt seals. And over the hundreds of thousands of years that passed, their fur changed color, they became white. Their fur actually is buoyant, which allows them to swim in the water. Their paws spread out and effectively worked as flippers so they could swim in the water as well. So they become a different species over the many, many years that they got separated. But they're very different animals when you encounter them. One is a sea mammal and one is a land mammal. But the polar bears are different from the grizzly bears in that they can effectively, you know, run as fast as a horse across the land like a grizzly can. So it's much trickier, and for me it was quite scary, you know, because the polar bears are so adept in any environment, and they would, you know, they can swim with just their nose, a black nose above the water, so that you can't see them. Or they can swim underwater. And I had that happen to me when I was in polar bear territory, and I couldn't see where the bear had gone.
Now, you mentioned that you and your companion, when you first went, your companion had a gun. And it was my understanding that you did not carry a gun early on, and the locals suggested that perhaps that you might want to do that, that bear spray was not enough. What is the story of John Waterman and bear spray?
I didn't write about it much in my book, Into the Thaw, but many of my trips to the north were actually guided trips where I had clients with me, and then I was, you know, duty-bound to carry a gun to protect my clients. But when I traveled alone, I often traveled without a gun because I felt like I'd been chased by enough bears that I thought, and this might sound arrogant to someone that hasn't been around grizzlies, but I felt like I understood bear behavior. But in 1997, for instance, I was traveling alone. I paddled across from the border from Canada into Alaska. And the first people I'd seen after 8 days was a boatload of hunters. And they said to me, "Did you see that polar bear?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, he's following you." And the polar bears are great swimmers. I was in a kayak. It might have been true. They might have seen it. They're very likely to have seen a polar bear that was swimming after me. There were two boatloads of hunters, and they invited me to camp with them that night because they were very worried about me. And in their tent, they were feeding me that night. They just killed a caribou, and they shared it with me. And finally, the Inuit and Inupiat people are very sensitive about not asking a lot of questions. It's considered rude to ask questions. But they were worried about me, and they were also very curious because they don't see many people traveling alone. Finally, the elder, everyone looks to the elders, the elder that is represents the group. The elder said to me, "What do you do if you see a polar bear?" And I took out my air horn and I showed him that. He wasn't very impressed by that. And I took out another device that I had. They're called bear bangers. You fire them into the air. They're spring-loaded devices, and they explode in the air like a firecracker. And he wasn't impressed with that. And then I took out my piece de resistance, which was a can of bear spray. And the tent went silent, and everyone looked to the elder. And the elder, with a shaky finger, pointed at the can of bear spray, which I'd set on the piece of plywood that served as their dinner table. And he said, "That just pissed the polar bear off."
John Waterman eventually left the polar bears and the Arctic and moved to Colorado. When he returned to the polar region 30 years later, what he saw surprised him.
I was aware that, of course, the world was undergoing a change in the climate, and I was aware that the Arctic was too, but because I had not visited this place for 30 years that I knew fairly well, I saw with my own eyes these radical changes.
He describes his visit to a thawing Arctic next. This episode of Big Picture Science is called Amazing Arctic.
Thank you.
John Waterman returned to the Arctic with his son Alistair in 2021 after a 30-year absence in what he has called his final expedition to a land that first captured his soul all those years ago. They traveled to the gates of Arctic National Park, and the changes John saw prompted him to return the following year with a photographer to document them. His book, Into the Thaw, Witnessing Wonder Amid the Arctic Climate Crisis, includes descriptions of changes to the Noatak River, into which that herd of caribou plunged during his first trip in the 1980s. But first, he describes whether his son Alistair had the same kind of wow moment that he had had upon first visiting the area.
Well, you know, teenagers are not, they're not always the most expressive, communicative human beings. And it wasn't until after the trip he told his grandmother that it was the most incredible thing he'd ever done. I knew that he enjoyed himself, and I knew there was a huge wow factor. The wow factor for him was seeing a bear with two cubs, and we had to wait an hour for these bears to continue slowly on their way so we could get back to camp because they cut us off from camp. Or just the float plane that took us in and picked us up and landed in the lake. You know, it's an incredible thing not only to fly in a small plane, but to land on a lake in the middle of the wilderness.
So let's talk about the way that the Arctic has changed over these 40 years. Perhaps we could start at how the river had changed, the Noatak River, on which 36 years prior, I believe, you had been a river guide, was noticeably different when you experienced it with your son.
We were delayed at least 2 days from flying into the river because it didn't stop raining. It was an epic kind of Noah's flood type of rainstorm. And by the time the rain stopped and we flew in, the river was over its banks. I'd never seen that before in the 3 or 4 trips I'd done several decades before. And in places, the river was just filled over the sandbars and up over potential campsites. And the current was running so fast, the raft that I was rowing with most of us on board, I had to pull really hard just to keep it from slamming into the banks. This was not the same river that I'd seen several decades previously.
It was warm enough to swim in.
Yeah, I mean, the principle changed. I mean, of course, it gets warm in the Arctic and always has, but this was really warm. I didn't bring any short pants because late August in the Arctic on the Noatak, I knew it was a cold place, but it was so warm that I wished that I'd brought shorts. And I would never have gone swimming in the river 30 years before. I also chose late August as, you know, thinking that I understood this environment as a good time because the frost usually begin in late August and it would kill off the mosquitoes. But the frost had not begun. So we had mosquitoes in the time of year where there normally were not mosquitoes. But, you know, the other thing that that didn't escape my notice was that the area was greatly brushed over. For instance, the place where I had found a wolf den in 1983, many years before, was head-high willows and dwarf birch, where it had been, you know, really just tundra in 1983. So this is a phenomenon known as the greening of the Arctic. Much of the Arctic is brushing over, trees are moving north. I was aware that, of course, that the world was undergoing a change in the climate, and I was aware that the Arctic was too, but because I had not visited this place for 30 years that I knew fairly well, I saw with my own eyes and through my memory these radical changes that incited me to come back the following year and carefully document them.
One of those changes was to the permafrost, and this is the thick layer of ground, although it can also be underwater, that remains frozen throughout the year. And as we know, it is melting. Could you talk, John, about the plant material and the microbes, all that is bundled and locked into it, and the world that is being transformed by the loss of that permafrost?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I called my book Into the Thaw, because I feel that the most extraordinary change in the North is the permafrost thaw. That, of course, works in conjunction with the diminishing sea ice. But the land itself is radically changing because it's as if, I described it in my book, as if you left frozen spinach out on the counter. It flattens out and loses its form.
So you're saying that some of the green, the plant material, is now exposed?
Yeah, this ancient plant matter, and as it thaws, it's being attacked by microbes, and then these microbes, as they eat the plant matter, are releasing carbon dioxide and the more potent greenhouse gas, methane. So it's not only a deformation of the physical landscape, it is a radical off-gassing, increasing the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, increasing the effects of the climate crisis.
And there's a word that you use that describes that, the changing of the landscape. I believe it's, I hope I pronounced this correctly, thermokarst?
That's correct, yes. That's the word that researchers and scientists and park technicians use to describe an area where the ground has slumped, whether it be a flat piece of ground that looks like a sinkhole or that's been flooded by a stream and thawed the permafrost underneath, or usually a thermokarst denotes a what looks like a landslide on hillsides or mountainsides where the permafrost is thawed and the land is just all moving downhill like the antithesis of a Hawaiian lava flow. It's, instead of hot, it's cold flow down the mountainside of this ancient frozen water just coming out of the earth and washing mud and silt into the river. In addition to the deformation of the land, in areas where there are villages, the buildings, the houses, are literally losing their foundations, and where they haven't built them up on jacks to insulate them from the permafrost, the houses are sinking into the earth, roads are sinking into the earth.
The subtitle of your book is not what we might associate with the effects of climate change. Your subtitle is Witnessing Wonder Amid a Climate Crisis. And I'm wondering if you mean that you're experiencing a sense of wonder despite the changes, or, which is in some ways reflected in your descriptions here, that the changes themselves are inspiring a kind of awe or a kind of curiosity.
Well, in a small way, yes, they are. And on the one hand, I'm fascinated by these earth processes. Normally, you know, incredibly slow glacial geologic processes are now sped up. So to bear witness to these is fascinating. But you know, frankly, most of my wonder is that I've always gone to the north and gone to nature, the natural world, because I'm interested in the animals and the natural world and the peace that I find. And that has not changed because of this climate crisis. Crisis, I think, in my subtitle, in my experiences in the north, refers more than anything to the culture, the people of the north, and to some extent to the wildlife that's affected by the climate crisis.
Well, let's talk more about that wildlife. You write about how the species, the wildlife, are reacting to the changing climate, and they're reacting in surprising ways. Some species are declining and others are surging. And I wonder if we could start with what you documented with the caribou that you had such memorable encounters with 40 years prior.
Well, the caribou is a keystone species, and you know, in Canada, the wildlife biologists and people who pay attention to these things are greatly alarmed because Canada has a much larger northern and Arctic space than we do in Alaska, and the caribou herds are all declining there. In Alaska, with the exception of one herd, all the herds have also diminished. Now, I will add that caribou populations are cyclic, and you know, over time they rise and they fall, but around the circumpolar Arctic, even beyond North America, all the caribou populations, most of the caribou populations are diminishing. And wildlife biologists attribute this to loss of habitat and to climate change. And this herd that I experienced on the no attack is the largest herd in the U.S. It's called the Western Arctic herd. And it was once numbered a 500,000, but now at the latest census done about a little more than a year ago, they're down to 152,000. So that's more than the normal sort of drop in caribou numbers, and again, is very representative of what's happening to the other herds.
But then you have animals like the beaver, which are moving in and finding a way to make a living, as it were, in places where they had not been, at least in such great number.
Yeah, the beavers are not an Arctic species. And, you know, any wildlife observer or biologist that study the beavers will quickly tell us that the beaver is an important ecosystem engineer. But that is in the southern biosphere. And in the north, where they are coming in droves, what they're doing, they're changing the ecosystem, as they do. They're damming up rivers and streams. And those new ponds, effectively, those ponds, the water will warm the surrounding permafrost and thaw the permafrost. So they are clearly re-engineering the Arctic ecosystem.
And so, John, how do you frame your thoughts about what comes next? Is it framed in terms of adaptation? I mean, that's inevitable, I guess. Do you frame it in terms of solving the climate crisis? How do you think about how we address this?
So the most important thing with this crisis is that adaptation. Specifically, there are several dozen villages that are going to have to be relocated in Alaska alone because of these extreme weather conditions, because of the diminishing sea ice that's causing these storm surges to wash over the villages because of flooding rivers. And so that adaptation, of course, is crucial. And at this point, secondarily, I mean, of course, we have to figure out how to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
I wonder if we could elaborate a bit on that idea of moving an entire village. If you're not a member of that village, you might think, oh, well, that's a nifty solution, just move, right? But it's actually profound, what you just said. And you visited one of these villages, Kivalina, I believe, and this is a village that the Army Corps of Engineers said would be affected by rising sea levels, and what they proposed is indeed, as you said, that they move. So this is an entire village, you know, in some cases maybe an ancestral village where people had been living for centuries, if not millennia, being asked to move somewhere else. Can you talk to us about how that would be done, and also that it evokes different emotions, doesn't it? On one hand, there's this kind of optimism that this is possible, but it's not the same as joy that it's happening.
The people of Kivalina are coastal people, and they have been for millennia. They depend upon and base their identities on the marine mammal life, the walruses, the seals, and the whales, which they hunt, and they've never caused the eradication of any of these species with their very minimalist needs in a tiny village. But to relocate, which they will have to do, they would have to move up into the hills, away from the ocean, away from the coast. And this is not a joyful prospect because their identities are there on the sea, and they would have to move away from the sea.
And yet, there's a possibility that people will be able to stay together, that the villagers will be able to stay together and continue. And that's in some ways how we've like lowered our bar for what we consider success now in responding to the climate crisis.
Yes, if we can't effectively enact Plan A, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, we have to prioritize Plan B, which is adaptation. And in this case, this culture that's very valuable to us, there are people, there are Americans, are being forced to relocate and literally change their identities.
Well, John Waterman, thank you so much for joining us and helping us travel vicariously through the Arctic We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Next, a polar scientist shares the latest research, which supports John's account of the changes he witnessed.
We do see that the Arctic is getting wetter. So there are a variety of things together that can all make it more possible to experience things like John Waterman saw with a warming river and also water flooding.
This episode of Big Picture Science that looks at the transformation of one of the world's last wild places is called Amazing Arctic. The Arctic has long filled its inhabitants and visitors with awe, but now the drama is unfolding in another way. We have extensive data about how the frozen landscape on top of our planet is responding to climate change, and it supports John Waterman's first-person account of a dramatically transformed Arctic.
My name's Twyla Moon. I'm a glaciologist, and I'm deputy lead scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center.
Dr. Moon pulls on insulated boots regularly to carry out her research in another part of the Arctic, Greenland. Twyla, let's start with temperatures. We have known for some time now that the Arctic is warming 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. What are the updates to those temperature trends?
You are absolutely correct that we are seeing the Arctic warm much more rapidly than the rest of the planet, and we have been seeing record heat there. 2023 set a temperature record for the Arctic. 2024 was right behind it. And so we're seeing temperatures that are warmer than those experienced elsewhere, and of course that means impacts are also coming faster to that region.
Can you say more about that trend of warming? Are we seeing the average temperature in the Arctic go up steadily over a number of years, or is it temperature spikes?
We can see both, that the average temperature is going up over year to year and over many decades, and we can see that we're achieving new extreme record temperatures. Because we're losing sea ice in the Arctic, that helps the Arctic take up more heat in the ocean. We're also warming the air in the Arctic, which actually puts more water vapor in the air. Water vapor actually helps to heat up the atmosphere. So both of those changes are speeding up the temperature change in the Arctic. And we're seeing record temperatures set in every season.
And these temperature records, of course, go back as long as we humans have been collecting temperature. I suppose you can get another record from ice cores and things like that. But how long back do some of these temperature records go?
Many of our temperature records go back to around 1900. There is a variation depending on where you're taking data, and the Arctic can be a difficult place to gather data over a long period of time, but certainly we have records that are more than 100 years old, and we can see that we're at record temperatures now. Just as you mentioned, we do have other tools we can use to understand past temperatures, and we can see that we're actually at warmer temperatures than we have seen over thousands of years.
Now, the phrase that I used to start off this conversation with you is that the Arctic is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. Why is it doing that? What is it about this frozen landscape that makes it so vulnerable to warming?
It is sometimes difficult to imagine, gosh, it's the cold place on Earth, and it is warming so quickly. But there are two primary elements at play. One is the Arctic is an ocean surrounded by continents. That ocean has historically been covered by sea ice, which is really bright and white. And you can imagine, you know, putting on your white t-shirt, walking outside in the hot sun, it's reflecting that heat and radiation, and you're really glad you put on a white t-shirt to stay cool. That's what the Arctic was doing, having sea ice on the ocean. It was reflecting back heat. But now we're losing that sea ice. We're exposing a really dark ocean surface. If you look at the ocean from space, it almost looks black. So imagine instead going outside with your black t-shirt on. It's suddenly soaking up all this heat and radiation, and that's what the ocean in the Arctic is doing now without that sea ice. So we're able to take up more heat in the ocean. The other thing that's happening is that we're warming the air in the Arctic. That warm air can hold more water vapor. That water vapor actually acts to retain heat in the atmosphere, and so we're getting more heat in the atmosphere too. So both these changes in sea ice and the ocean, as well as our changes in our atmosphere, are working together to really speed up heating in the Arctic.
Let's keep talking about sea ice. I understand that sea ice in February of 2025 was at its lowest level for the month of February. Sea ice normally grows and shrinks seasonally. And can you describe what we are seeing now, what alterations, what changes we are seeing to that growth and shrinkage of sea ice?
Yeah, so sea ice is formed from freezing the surface of the ocean. So if you have very cold air temperatures, you can freeze the ocean surface. Now, if that ocean is a warmer temperature, it's going to be harder work to freeze the top of it than if that ocean surface water is cool. And so areas all throughout the Arctic Ocean in the north, and also then surrounding Antarctica in the Southern Ocean, are areas where we get really cold air temperatures and it freezes the surface of the ocean to form sea ice. In both of these locations, you can have sea ice that forms in winter, and then it manages to survive the next summer. It doesn't get melted, and it sticks around, and then it starts to build up more sea ice, and we get what we call multi-year sea ice, which is sea ice that sticks around year after year. It gets really thick, and it produces kind of a special kind of habitat platform. Now, what we're seeing is that we are warming the air, so it's harder to get those really cold air temperatures to freeze the ocean surface, and we're also heating up the ocean. It's harder to get the cold ocean temperatures to make it freeze easily. These things together mean that we have seen some really dramatic losses in sea ice.
And the sea ice are those great big, I should say, sometimes small, but big slabs of ice that are floating. So they are actually in the ocean as opposed to glaciers, which are on land, and even ice sheets, which are on land.
Yeah, that's correct. We have a difference between what I would call sea ice, the ice formed from freezing the ocean. And so that sea ice is going to be a little bit salty and briny, or land ice. That's glaciers, the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica, and that land ice is formed from snow falling on land, so it's entirely fresh water. So these are different sources. Sea ice is not influencing sea level rise, while changes in land ice, glaciers, and ice sheet does. But sea ice plays this really important role of covering the ocean surface and giving this bright white reflective surface on top of the ocean.
Have you ever stood on a bit of sea ice? Does it feel like you're standing on like a surfboard and you're kind of bopping up and down, or does it just feel like you're standing on solid ground?
There is a wide variety of types of sea ice, and sea ice can feel really stable. You've had people set up, you know, full research camps on the top of sea ice. People can be out there for days. So the sea ice can feel surprisingly stable and extensive. Unfortunately, it can also get really thin and fragile and vulnerable and be really dangerous to travel on for people and animals too.
Well, just that gives us an idea of just how much ice we're talking about. And according to reports, the Arctic is estimated to be ice-free by 2050. And Twyla, when we talk about the Arctic being ice-free, does that refer to the sea ice or the glaciers and the ice sheets, or is it the whole kit and caboodle?
When we talk about the Arctic being ice-free, we are talking about the sea ice in the ocean. The land ice that we have in the Greenland ice sheet or glaciers in Canada or Alaska, for example, are melting more slowly, whereas the sea ice responds very quickly to changes in atmosphere temperature and seasonal ability to grow sea ice in winter versus how much is melting in summer. So that ice-free Arctic phrase is talking about sea ice.
We spoke with author John Waterman earlier in the show, and he described his experience of returning to the Arctic and going to the Noatak River, where 36 years earlier he had been a river guide. And it had changed so much as to be almost unrecognizable to him. He said that the water was overflowing onto the sandbars and the campsites, and that the river was warm enough to swim in. Twyla, what is causing the river to overflow, or could you speculate? Is that because there's been melt, or is climate change causing more rain? But when you see river water rising like that, what's behind it?
There can be a variety of elements that are making a particular river flood at a specific time. But we do see that the Arctic is getting wetter. We see more precipitation falling each year. That includes both the potential for big snow in winter, but also big rain events during any season now of the year. As we thaw the permafrost or frozen ground that covers the Arctic too, that landscape also becomes more vulnerable to erosion. It can change the shape of the river and where river water is moving. So there are a variety of things together that can all make it more possible to experience things like John Waterman saw with a warming river and also water flooding.
Now, you work in Greenland, which is part of the Arctic, and have you seen, this is speaking perhaps anecdotally, you also are someone who collects data, but from your personal experience, have you seen Greenland change over the time that you've been working there?
I have seen Greenland change so much. To be honest, it has really been difficult to watch. So not only have I spent time in Greenland on the ground and speaking to people and understanding how they're seeing less sea ice, understanding how they're experiencing floods from ice sheet melt during the summer, but I also spend a lot of time studying Greenland using pictures from space. And that means that this ice sheet that covers the world's largest island, it's more than 2 miles thick in the interior. I can look at all of it at once, and I have over my career been watching that edge of the ice sheet shrink back and back, often by kilometers, as well as losing elevation. So even just in my career, I mean, I don't consider myself a particularly old person, but I have already been able to see truly stunning changes in the Greenland ice sheet.
Just as an aside, I remember talking to a Greenland researcher 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when they were reporting, the scientists were reporting that it was hard to for helicopters to land and take off because the ground had become so mushy. And that image has just stayed with me.
Yes, that is associated with that thawing of the permafrost or frozen ground, which is definitely a problem all around the Arctic.
There's a phrase that John used in his description, an evocative phrase that John used in his description of what he was seeing, and he called it the greening of the Arctic. What does that mean to you as a scientist?
He is fully accurate that we are seeing the greening of the Arctic. Now, for us as scientists, that means that the Arctic is seeing more plant growth, shrubby plants, bigger grasses, these sorts of things. And I think our gut reaction is to think that greening sounds like a good thing, but for the Arctic, it's not necessarily a good thing. So for example, caribou are one of the really important species in the Arctic that also many people there depend on for food. And those caribou actually consume lichen and other plants that are now being crowded out by shrubs and other plants that are causing this greening. So for the Arctic, greening is not necessarily a good thing, but it's perhaps not a surprising outcome of warming air temperatures that are also shortening our winter season so that you have more time for plant growth and also higher temperatures. And as I said earlier, also more rain and wet in the Arctic.
Well, Twyla, we started this episode with the description of the Arctic Circle, a place that is actually imaginary, you know, demarcated by an imaginary line, and a place that being at the top of the world feels remote. It is remote. But what you're telling us, you're suggesting, is the rest of the world is connected to it. In fact, we are connected to both poles. Can you perhaps even just reiterate and help us understand that, you know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. We are connected to this remote place.
It is so well said that we are deeply connected to the Arctic. As we lose land ice in the Arctic, ironically, it actually produces the biggest impacts far from where you lose that land ice. So people on the US Gulf Coast feel a much bigger impact from losses in Greenland than the people in Greenland. We're really closely connected to that change. As we're thawing permafrost and releasing new heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere, they mix really quickly in the atmosphere. That's a fast-moving space around us. And so that produces heating that we can feel far away. The other thing that happens is as we're heating up the Arctic, we can change the way air moves around the planet, and that can actually mean that we can more easily have cold air outbreaks at latitudes far from the Arctic. So think of like a big polar vortex outbreak in Texas, for example, paired with bringing warm air further up. So we're getting this wavy pattern that can make a person in the central US think, brr, I gotta find my puffy and my hat. Well, someone on the East Coast is considering turning on their air conditioning. And this kind of weather whiplash and strong regional contrast can be really confusing. I actually really prefer to call this global weirding, because I think that's what our experience is like. And for that, those of us far from the Arctic are directly feeling the changes occurring there.
Twyla Moon, thank you so much for joining us to talk about the changes in the Arctic. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for discussing this important topic.
Twyla Moon is a glaciologist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center who works on the Greenland ice sheet. This show is made possible thanks to astronomer and producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, and assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. We give a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, that looks at how a warming planet is changing its northern frozen landscape, is called Amazing Arctic.
This program was brought to you by Jim and Shirley Brown's Apartments, located in Sand Point above Trident Seafoods and the Boat Harbor, featuring two-bedroom apartments on a month-to-month basis. For more information, call Jim Brown at 386-6050.